Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I called up Champ Barton from over at The Trace to talk about a totally new way to think about gun control. But honestly, I can't shake the very first thing he told me, a fact that seems to explain just how hard it is to prevent gun violence in the first place.
If you want to buy a gun in Mexico, there's one gun store, and it's on an army base.
Hold on, one gun store?
There's just one in the entire country.
I live in a country, the United States, where there are twice as many gun stores as there are post offices. So it kind of blows my mind that just across the border things work like this. To get a gun legally in Mexico, you go through months of background checks. You apply for a temporary permit, and then you go to that military base. When the LA Times visited a few years back, the store sold just 38 guns a day to civilians. And all this is even more shocking when you think about the kinds of news stories we Americans are used to hearing about Mexico.
A torrent of gunfire sending dozens of people running for their lives.
Since 2010, more than 200,000 people have been killed by guns there.
In Mexico, at least 10 people are dead and 9 others wounded after gunmen ambushed a group of drivers at a road race event.
The shooting happened in the town of Coronado, prompting businesses nearby to close down.
With innocent people caught in the crossfire.
Can you explain that disconnect to me? Because it just seems profound.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest issue is just that, you know, there's thousands of American guns that are crossing the border every year into Mexico. I think it comes out to somewhere between like 360 to 597,000 guns a year that come over the border.
If I was Mexico, I'd be pretty pissed.
Yeah.
Mexico is pissed. So pissed, in fact, that it's taking American gun makers to court.
Mexico has filed a lawsuit against U.S. gun manufacturers claiming they're responsible for the illegal flow of guns into the country.
With this case, the Mexican government is arguing we should think about American gun makers the same way we think about tobacco companies or opioid distributors, as an industry that really should know better.
Mexico accuses those companies of aiding and abetting an illegal trafficking network of weapons from American gun stores to Mexican cartels.
Were you surprised when Mexico decided to file a lawsuit against U.S. gun manufacturers?
I mean, definitely. It's not something that we had ever seen before. This Mexico case was an example to me of a new, fresh attempt at getting at this problem, which, you know, experts and researchers and advocates have for decades been saying traces back to industry distribution practices.
Today on the show, the Mexican government versus American guns. Can a lawsuit do what politicians haven't? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2.
We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
For the last couple of years, the Mexican government has been moving forward this lawsuit against U.S.-based gun manufacturers. Tell me who exactly Mexico is suing here.
So Mexico is suing seven gun manufacturers and one gun distributor. The seven gun manufacturers are manufacturers whose guns most frequently turn up at crime scenes in Mexico. And so these are some of the biggest gun makers in America: Colt, Smith & Wesson, Glock, Beretta. You know, huge names.
Familiar names.
Yeah, very much so. And they're suing these companies, basically alleging that they have conspired or aided and abetted gun trafficking operations knowingly with the intent of profiting off of that market.
Do they have proof that these manufacturers are helping sort of drive the flow of guns from the U.S. to Mexico?
We can't say if they have proof yet, right? Like, you don't have to prove a case before you bring it. What they have to prove to a judge, and what they at this point have proved to a judge, is that their allegations are plausible. And so if you look at the data on gun violence in Mexico relative to gun production in the U.S., you can see, and they include a pretty stark graphic of this in their complaint, you can see a pretty clear relationship between gun homicides on Mexican soil and U.S. gun production. As gun production goes up in the U.S., gun homicides go up in Mexico, generally. There's a lot of data that they include in their complaint, but that sort of distills it down to its most central point, which is that there is a clear relationship here between what goes on in the U.S. in terms of its gun market and what goes on in Mexico in terms of its gun violence problem. And their argument is that those two things are related and that they'll be able to prove that in court.
How exactly does a gun move from a U.S.-based manufacturer across the border to Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, so the market is basically the exact same as it would be for a U.S. gun buyer up until the point of that final transaction. So the manufacturer makes the weapon. They send it usually to a wholesaler. The wholesaler will sell it to a dealer. The dealer will then put it in their shop, and someone can come in and buy it. In the case of the guns that are trafficked, very often what's happening is that people are going into those stores, they're buying the guns with the intent of trafficking them, or because they've been tapped by someone who is working with a gun trafficking ring to buy the gun. And then once that gun is purchased, it's then smuggled south of the border, you know, any number of ways. And I think that the exact path that the guns take after they leave the store is unclear. What is clearer is that a lot of these stores wind up selling very many guns in very suspiciously large quantities or suspiciously frequent quantities in suspicious areas to, you know, the same people who, you know, they should have reason to believe are doing something that's against the law.
And is anyone asking any questions about this along the way? Like, I don't know, the ATF or like the gun distributors themselves?
I know that for a long time, gun manufacturers and gun wholesalers have sort of they've refused to agree that they should police their distribution chains more rigorously and that would reduce gun violence. The ATF, though, does ask questions about this. There are requirements for gun stores to notify the ATF when, you know, there's been multiple sales of a handgun, for example, to the same buyer in a short time frame. So those things do happen. Those notifications do happen. But I think, like, in the grander scheme of things, what has to occur is that these things need to be caught in the moment. And I think it's hard for an agency like the ATF to keep tabs. There's so many gun stores in the U.S. And so they're only conducting inspections, as you know, our reporting has shown, something like once every 7 years of most gun dealers. And so that's a pretty light regulatory regime for those stores that are intending to do dirty business.
Yeah. In this lawsuit, what's Mexico asking for? Like, what would make this better to them? At least right now, at the outset of this litigation.
I mean, I think that the fundamental legal claim that the Mexican government is making is that they should be entitled to damages, financial damages, and some sort of injunctive relief for the expenses that they have had to incur to try to combat this problem. And so the argument basically goes like, you know, the Mexican government has had to beef up its police forces and its military forces. There's been extraordinary cost in their judicial system, and all of those costs are associated with this problem. And their claim is that that problem is caused by the, you know, gun makers' specific intentional profiteering off of this trafficking network.
A lot of people compare this lawsuit to tobacco litigation, right? How does that litigation compare with what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, the general philosophy behind a lot of those lawsuits was that you had an industry that was selling a product that was causing harm to the general public, and that industry was not doing everything within its power, and not even doing the things that it knew it could do to limit the harm that its product caused the public. And so if you think about it in those terms, it's very similar to what is being alleged of the gun makers.
To me, it seems so similar to actually the opioid litigation that moved forward recently, because the allegations in some of that litigation were basically that drug makers had data showing opioids were streaming into certain areas of the country in really concerning ways, and they just didn't investigate what was going on.
Sure. I mean, there was a time in the U.S. in which that comparison was almost like perfect, because it used to be that when a firearm was traced, the ATF needed to, you know, pick up a phone and dial the manufacturer and inform them, hey, this gun with this serial number turned up at a crime scene. Who did you sell it to?
Wow.
And then they would have to say, oh, we've sold it to this wholesaler, and they would go on down the chain like that. What's happened since around 2000, the ATF essentially set up servers in like the database of manufacturers and wholesalers. And they use those servers to ping the sort of acquisition and disposition logs at these companies so that they don't have to make a phone call, right? Now, I don't know specifically what the rules are about the companies who are sort of agreeing to these policies, actually seeing the pings that they're getting, for example, for guns that have turned up. Like, it may be something that they're not allowed to look at. I just don't know. But I do know that that data is available. It's there. And I cannot imagine that if they wanted to look at it, that the ATF would refuse to allow them to look at it.
With the opioids, I think that the drug manufacturers were required to intervene in some way when they saw increased use like this. But it sounds like with the guns, it's a little more fuzzy.
There's certainly no requirement in the U.S. for the gun makers to do anything of the sort. They do not have to police their distribution. They do not, like, the attitude of the industry, as far as I have been doing this reporting, has always been hands off. The law enforcement side of this equation is the ATF's job. It's not for us to do anything about. So if the ATF tells us to stop selling somewhere, we'll stop selling. But if the ATF hasn't told us there's a problem, we're not going to find one and act on our own sort of volition here.
I want to talk about the people who brought this gun case, because I think it's a really interesting piece of the puzzle. The case was obviously brought by Mexico against the U.S. manufacturers, but they're being helped by American lawyers, right?
Yeah. I mean, John Lowy used to be lead counsel at Brady, the prominent gun violence prevention group.
The Brady Center for Gun Violence.
That's right. But John Lowy has been doing this sort of litigation for decades. He is currently involved in other lawsuits that are alleging, making very similar allegations to the government of Mexico. The city of Gary, Indiana has a suit right now. That suit's been going on for 20 some odd years. And he recently split off from Brady, and he founded his own gun violence prevention group called Global Action on Gun Violence.
John Lowy is an interesting character to me, because when he was at the Brady Center, he wrote this report, and this is way back in 2009, talking about the ways that gun manufacturing in the U.S. is connected to crime in Mexico. And at the time, one of the real focuses of this report was weak gun laws in the U.S., basically saying weak gun laws are making it so that guns from the U.S. are going to Mexico. So why didn't he want to fix the weak American laws? Like, this lawsuit isn't going after the laws. It's going after the gun manufacturers.
I'll say this. I don't think that those two things are mutually exclusive, first of all. Second of all, I think this comes back to what we were talking about earlier in this conversation, which is that there is a calculus that anybody who is interested in addressing this problem has to make. And that calculus is about what action is going to most efficiently deal with this problem and which has the potential for the greatest, you know, reduction of harm, basically. And I think that it has been sort of an obvious, like so obvious it almost doesn't need saying thing in the U.S. that gun violence prevention laws and legislation is just a total non-starter politically. There's just such a model from these other corporate accountability movements that we've been discussing, the opioid litigation, the tobacco litigation, the automotive litigation, that shows that there is an avenue for justice through the courts generally when corporations' products are associated with such widespread harm. And I think that the calculus that has been made by a lot of these people who are involved in these lawsuits is that this is a quicker, more efficient, and potentially more effective way to reduce gun violence.
After the break, can this case crack the legal shield that has been protecting the gun industry for decades?
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Okay, let's talk about some challenges this lawsuit is going to face as it moves through the courts. The first is whether this lawsuit can move forward at all. Why wouldn't this lawsuit be able to move forward? What would keep it out of a courtroom?
I mean, the lawsuit's been dismissed once. It was dismissed in 2022 on account of this federal law known as the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which was passed in the early aughts as a way to get rid of a bunch of lawsuits that were making very similar allegations to the Mexican government. And so this law was passed to essentially get rid of those lawsuits, to say that you cannot sue a gun maker as a result of harms caused by people who have, you know, committed crimes with their weapons.
Seems like a pretty nice piece of legislation if you're a gun manufacturer.
It has been a very nice piece of legislation for them, and it has stifled the kind of legal maturation that I was describing earlier. You know, I think this is a really important point for people to understand. The litigation against the opioid manufacturers, to come back to that comparison, it didn't start in 2015. It didn't start when opioid deaths were all over the news, you know, in the late 2010s. It started in the late 1990s. It started at the same time that they were trying to sue gun makers. And most of those early suits just weren't successful because the legal theories that they were working with, you know, hadn't been worked out yet. There was compelling arguments to dismiss these cases. And over time, people kept trying to bring these lawsuits because the problem persisted. And eventually they settled on a legal theory that allowed those suits to proceed. The Mexican government has, you know, attempted a novel legal strategy to bring this case forward. And not a lot of plaintiffs within the U.S. have had an opportunity to make those same attempts, which would have pointed in the direction of new strategies for suing gun makers. And so that law has really kept industry accountability just sort of off the books for the past two decades almost.
Didn't the Sandy Hook parents, weren't they able to sue the gun manufacturers? What made their case different?
Yes, they were. So to back up, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act has a few exceptions. You know, if a gun maker sells a defective product, for example, then they can be sued. If a gun maker breaches a contract, they can be sued. The exception that gets targeted the most for plaintiffs who are trying to hold gun makers accountable for gun violence and for negligent distribution practices is this exception known as the predicate exception, which allows for lawsuits when they're brought based on harm caused by the violation of a state or federal statute that is, quote unquote, applicable to the sale or marketing of firearms. Basically, what that means is that if you're going to sue a gun maker, you have to sue them saying that they have violated a law, that you were harmed because they violated a law that's specifically related to the sale or marketing of firearms. And so what the Sandy Hook parents did was they sued saying that they were harmed by the gun maker's violation of an unfair trade practices law in Connecticut. And the judge agreed that that law applied to the sale or marketing of firearms.
How is the Mexican government arguing that their case should be allowed to proceed?
Yeah, so originally the Mexican government tried to argue that the PLCAA should just not apply at all because they're a foreign government. That argument was dismissed by this federal district court in Massachusetts in 2022. The court basically said that, no, PLCAA does apply to your lawsuit, and you have not met the criteria for any of these exceptions. They appealed, and in January of this year, they were successful on that appeal in arguing not that PLCAA should not apply. The appeals court agreed PLCAA applies to their case, but that they do fit one of PLCAA's exceptions, namely the same exception that the Sandy Hook families targeted. And the reason for that is that the Mexican government has alleged that the gun makers have violated laws having to do with straw purchasing, laws having to do with exporting firearms without a license, laws having to do with selling firearms without a license. And they've basically said that these gun makers were in some way conspirators with the stores along the border that have participated in these trafficking rings.
If this lawsuit does move forward, even then, I don't think it's a slam dunk. Like, one argument the industry makes here is, listen, Mexico needs to get its own house in order. Like, control your gangs. Like, the problem is not the guns from us. The problem is the people bringing the guns in. What do you make of that argument?
I mean, look, all this stuff needs to be shaken out at trial. And if it goes to trial and the defense, the gun makers, are able to prove that they were not indeed intentionally and knowingly sort of facilitating the trafficking of weapons across the border, then sure, that's sort of the reality that we're left with. But what the Mexican government says it is able to prove and will be able to prove with discovery is that these gun makers aren't just turning a blind eye. It's that they're being trafficked over the border because that's what the gun makers want, because it's a very lucrative segment of their industry. That would certainly seem to me to be a sort of a slam dunk, in the sense that you would have for the first time had a court decide that the distribution practices of the gun industry are like directly responsible for the harms caused by gun violence down the line. And that would really be a profound ruling.
This lawsuit is clearly part of a wider push to change how gun control works in this country.
When you look ahead, I don't know, 5 years, how easy is it to imagine a world where there are more cases like this from other places that are basically saying the U.S. is fueling gun violence and we want accountability?
Yeah, I mean, I think like 5 years down the line, there is some sort of instruction for domestic plaintiffs here, which is that if this strategy by the Mexican government holds and it's not overturned by the Supreme Court, then you have an opportunity for domestic plaintiffs to, you know, make a similar argument. And now it's a question of whether or not they could prove it. You know, we don't know. The other important thing to note is that while this Mexican government's case has gone on, you know, potential U.S. plaintiffs have not just been sitting idly by. Several cities across the country have passed laws over the past 3 years to amend their state public nuisance statutes or to add new laws on the books that make explicit their connection to the sale or marketing of firearms. And those laws were put on the books with the intent of easing the route in through this predicate exception to the PLCAA.
So this law, PLCAA, that was passed in 2005 to protect the gun industry, is it still working to do that?
It's hard to say. I mean, what qualifies as working? It has prevented for many years the development of this litigation. It has prevented for many years gun manufacturers having to turn over important documents in discovery. You could certainly interpret these few successful moves as like a growing network of cracks in the shield that maybe one day will just give way.
Champ Barton, I'm super grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Champ Barton writes for The Trace. And that's the show. If you are a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Catherine Fink, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate, and I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.